That's it. Okay. Good. Okay, welcome everybody. Nice to see you here. I think I'm a bit late, actually. I didn't know the time. I think all the clocks around here are on different times. So this is what happens. Okay. But as Ram says, disorganized religion. That's how we start. Are we ready to begin? Yeah? Yeah. Okay, so the sutta I'm going to do today is the Sabbasava Sutta, which is the second sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. I think the reason it hasn't been done before is because Ajahn Brahm usually does these suttas at the monastery every couple of years. So I think he gets sort of, when you do them every 2 years, you sort of get enough for the sutta afterwards. He probably has never done it here before. But since he does it in the monastery, I thought I could do it here. And it's quite a good sutta, so I thought it might be a good one to actually do. And essentially, this sutta, Sabbasava, Majjhima 2, yeah? There should be some photocopies coming in soon for those who haven't got anything here. So probably arriving in a couple of minutes. Somebody's actually on the job. And this sutta really is an alternative view of like the gradual training. It shows the training from the beginning to the very end, but in a kind of alternative way. And so it is actually, I think it's quite interesting. There are a few things in there which are maybe kind of very sort of monastic in there. The way it is explained, but nevertheless, I think it's a very useful sutta. So let us just start. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this: "Bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on the restraint of all the taints. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, venerable sir," the bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. So, it starts off in the very beginning here, saying that this is going to be a discourse on all the taints. Now, this word taints, the Pali word behind this, is the word called asava, and it's a very kind of important word in the suttas. And it's anasava in the suttas is like the root defilements that you have to sort of root out to achieve full awakening or full enlightenment. That's what the asavas are. And you always see that when somebody becomes an arahant, it always says that the asavas have been removed. He has understood the asavas. How does that formula go again? Anyway, the asavas are gone. That's basically the essence of it. So the asavas are like the root defilement. And it's interesting to actually reflect a little bit about what do these things actually mean, because it's not at all obvious what this word means. And here it is translated as taints. And I mean, the word taint is like, you know, it's like something, it's like a, I think it's something which kind of discolors something a little bit or something like that. And some people have pointed out that they feel it's a too weak a word to be used for asavas, because asavas are quite strong mental contaminants or defilements or problems, mental problems, basically. But the root meaning of this word is from the meaning to flow. Asava. Sav, the middle part there, actually means to flow. And because that word means to flow, and the prefix either means in or out, the root meaning of this seems to be either to flow in or to flow out. And of course, we're dealing with the mind here, or the person. So it's flowing into the mind or flowing out of the mind. So, and there are good grounds for thinking it could mean either. Either flowing in, for example, could mean like, you know, the external world is flowing into you. It's like, you know, you're disturbing yourself, so to speak, if you are nice and peaceful and all these images and things come into you. And then that gives rise to defilements. Or it could mean you kind of going out into the world, right? Grasping onto things, craving for things. So you going out. So there's a fairly good reason for thinking it could mean either outflowing or like inflowing. And sometimes if you want to decide what a sutta actually means, one of the great ways of deciding on these things is to look at how a word is used in different contexts. Particular context where a word is used like in an everyday way, because the everyday way is usually where they have the meaning is most clear, right? you see something used, you're doing the dishes, or you're doing something very ordinary. And when you do something very ordinary, that's when you're using the word in its most kind of ordinary sense, so to speak. And what it seems to mean in that sense is basically outflowing seems to be more like the right meaning of it. So something flowing out. You like going out into the world. And that's what Ajahn Brahm likes to translate asavas, the outflowing, the mind going out into the world, craving, holding on to things. So of these asavas, the first one is the kamasava. So kamasava is the asava of sensual desire. So it's like the mind going out into the world, grabbing hold of sensual objects to satisfy sensual desire, basically. So you can see there how flowing out actually works quite well here. But many people have said that maybe the best thing to do is to just forget about the whole idea of flowing in or flowing out, and just say that asava actually is just a defilement, or it's a problem. You can translate it as a problem or a defilement. A taint might be a little bit too weak. Ajahn Tanisiro translated as fermentation. I'm not entirely sure exactly what he means by that, but I think a problem is perfectly, probably a very simple and straightforward translation of the word asava. A problem or a defilement, basically. And you will see later on in the text that the word problem actually fits the context quite well there. So that just a quick discussion for you on the meaning of the word asava. Basically, it's a problem, very deep-seated problem in the mind. Okay. Then the Buddha goes on. Bhikkhus, I say that the destruction of the taints is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. Who knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. When one attends unwisely, unarisen taints arise and arisen taints increase. When one attains wisely, unarisen taints do not arise, and arisen taints are abandoned. So, so here he is saying that the destruction of the taints is for one who knows and sees. And of course, knowing and seeing in Buddhism, the kind of the deepest way, the most, the deepest meaning of that is basically being a stream winner, an Arya, right? Somebody who has seen the Dhamma. That's kind of the usual, what we usually mean by knowing and seeing. But it's important to remember that many of these words, they have like, it's almost like a double meaning in a sense. They have like, on the one hand, the absolute meaning. And when we talk about absolutely knowing and seeing, we mean the Arya Pugala, the person who is a noble one, because they have actually seen fully. They really know. But it's an absolute kind of knowing and seeing. But there's also the relative knowing and seeing here. And the relative knowing and seeing is like what ordinary people have, right? Sometimes you know, sometimes you see rightly here. And at that point, you have something which approximates the knowledge and seeing of the stream winner. Maybe not 100%, but at least moving in the right direction. And then you get confused again, and you lose that knowing and seeing here. So there is both the absolute and also the relative. And that is quite, it's a distinction that we see throughout the suttas. Is this idea that words have often this double meaning, and they can mean different things in different contexts. There is the absolute meaning, and then there's the relative meaning. And here, it is one such instance where this actually has both the absolute meaning and a relative meaning, depending on how you want to read it. So it is for one who knows and sees. Knows and sees what? Knows and sees wise attention and unwise attention. And this is a very important concept in Pali. Wise attention is yoniso manasikara, and unwise attention is ayoniso manasikara. A very kind of foundational term which is used throughout the suttas. And quite literally, yoni actually means womb in the Pali. So womb is like a source, right? It's something where something comes from. So it means like source. So it's attention that relates to the source of things. It's like the opposite of superficial attention. You really go all the way into the problem and you see things at the source. And when you see things at the source, that's when you gain a good understanding of what is going on. So this is the importance of this word, yoniso manasikara. And the other one is ayoniso manasikara. It's like superficial attention. You stop at the surface, you see things for what they seem to be, without actually penetrating properly underneath. And this yoniso manasikara is something that actually you need all the way on the path. You need it from the very beginning to the very end. Right? If you come around and you listen to the Buddha's teachings the first time, to be able to understand that these are valuable teachings, you need a little bit of yoniso manasikara. Otherwise, if you just have a superficial reflection, you think, what's the point of this? I just want to go out and have fun and have a good time. I don't really want to, it's too much hassle to keep the five precepts and these kind of things. So, again, already there, just to gain a sense of confidence in the Buddha's teachings, you need some degree of yoniso manasikara. And this has to go with you all the way along the path, from the beginning, all the way till you become an arahant. Of course, once you become a stream enter, then you know what these things are. So that point is pretty much automatic, but at least until that point. So this is a very foundational term. And you see, for example, in the Anguttara Nikaya 1s, it says there that yoniso manasikara is one of those things that are the most foundational things on the Buddhist path. If that isn't in place, you're not going to go anywhere. It's a bit like this word appamada in Pali. Appamada is translated very beautifully as heedfulness. And heedfulness has this sense, the word heedful is not a very common word, but it means like being careful, right? Or being careful and being circumspect and, not kind of making rash decisions. You are heedful about things. You look at things carefully. And that is what, and this is very similar to that. You're careful. You look at things in a wise way. You go to the source rather than looking at things superficially. So this is this yoniso manasikara. And the thing here is that you actually understand the distinction between the two. You know what deep attention is, and you know what kind of superficial attention is. It's very closely related to view, to right view and wrong view. If you have wrong view about something, it means that you tend to sort of not see the deeper aspects of something. And right view is the, you actually see things in the right, in a way which accords with reality. You see things as impermanent, etc. And this is very closely related to that. Okay, so that is, so it is a very interesting thing that it says that you actually know what wise attention is, and you know what unwise attention is. You are able to know inside of yourself whether you are attending in the right way. It's quite interesting, isn't it? You actually understand your attention, whether it's deep or not. And because of that understanding, you can actually choose for yourself which way you want to attend. If you don't understand the distinction, you're just going to look at things superficially or, in a random way, you don't really get anywhere. And I don't think what is meant here is that you actually have this kind of, it's not as if you sit back and you sort of think about it, this is wise attention, this is unwise attention. I mean, most people don't do that. You don't actually, have a kind of intellectual exercise where you decide what things are. It's more like an intuition, right? That's how you come to Buddhism. You think, you sit there and you just listen. Yeah, this seems right. And that's my deep or wise attention, without you really knowing that you're doing it. It's more like an intuition, maybe something that you carry with you from the past, maybe from a past life or whatever. Okay, so, and then he says, when one attends unwisely, when one attends unwisely, unarisen taints or unarisen problems arise, and arisen taints increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise, and arisen taints are abandoned. So this is the problem with wrong attention. Wrong attention means that you're causing problems. You're basically creating suffering, right? This is what unwise attention does. Whereas the wise attention, where the taints are abandoned, you're actually reducing the suffering. You're reducing the problem. And eventually, of course, you're abandoning the problem altogether. That is what this is about here. And of course, if you know, many of you probably know what this is about straight away. Actually, we have some suttas just arriving. So for those who haven't got them. So yeah, I just have to warn you, this translation is a little bit different from the one I'm reading from. So it's not going to be exactly the same, but at least you have something you can refer to if you need to. Okay. So important is when you look at things in a way which is not really in accordance with the way they are. You think that something is happiness when actually there is a problem with it, right? Or you see things as permanent when in fact they change much faster than we like to admit. Or you feel a sense of self inside of you, huh? When in fact there is no such thing. That is, of course, the Buddhist idea of unwise attention. Seeing, instead of seeing the three characteristics of existence from the Buddhist point of view, you're seeing them as the mind tends to do when it hasn't actually seen the truth properly here. So that is what is meant here. There's one slightly, I think, point here which is worth mentioning here, and that is that the word taint here, which is asava, is actually used in two different ways in exactly the same paragraph here. So this is a bit confusing here, so it's probably worth having a quick look at. In the first line there, it says the destruction of the taints. Now, when it talks about the destruction of the taints, it talks about the destruction of the three taints that are found everywhere in the suttas, which is the kamasava, the bhavasava, and the avijasava, the taint of sensual desire, the taint of existence, and the taint of ignorance. These are the three taints that are talked about in the suttas. And it's the destruction of those three taints, or the ending of those three taints, which then is awakening, right? Arahantship. But when it says further down, it says that unarisen taints do not arise, or arisen taints increase, then we're not talking about that taints in the same way. Here, taint has a much broader meaning. Here it just means any kind of problem that arises in your mind, right? So these are two separate meanings here of the word taints. One, it means a problem in general. In the first case, it just means a very specific problem that stops you from being fully awake in an arahant. And then here again, you can see this idea, this thing that words have like a duality of meanings in the suttas. Sometimes they have like an absolute meaning, and the first one there is the absolute meaning. When it has a very technical sense, it means the three things that stop you from being an arahant. And the second one has like a general meaning here, where it just means any problem basically of the mind. So and this is a usage which is quite specific to this sutta here. Usually, asava just means the technical three things that stop you from being an arahant. Okay, so that is about attending wisely and attending unwisely here. Yeah, one of the interesting things as well, but maybe I should just mention briefly, is that there are suttas which talk about the factors that lead to becoming a stream enterer. And what leads you to become a stream enterer is one of the clue components of that is actually wise attention, yonisomanasikara. It's either the paratogosa, which literally means the voice of another. In other words, you have to hear the teachings, the right teachings. And then it also is the yoniso manasikara, which is your own wise attention to the problem. So those two come together, and that's why, obviously, one reason why the yoniso manasikara is so important here. Okay, so let's go on to the next paragraph here. Bhikkhus, there are taints that should be abandoned by seeing. There are taints that should be abandoned by restraining. There are taints that should be abandoned by using. There are taints that should be abandoned by enduring. There are taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. There are taints that should be abandoned by removing. And there are taints that should be abandoned by developing. So this is like the summary of the sutta. And the rest of the sutta is an expansion on these seven, is it seven? I think it's seven types of taints. As usual in the suttas, when you have a sequence like this, things coming one after the other, it usually means that there is a gradation. This is not a random sequence. Very rare in the suttas that any sequence is random. Usually there is a gradation in that particular sequence. And that is certainly the case here. There is a gradation in these things. For that reason, the first one here is the one to abandon by seeing. And as we shall see, the seeing here actually means becoming a stream enter. So in a sense, that is the first aspect of the path. This is idea that you see here. And once, of course, you are a stream enter, that means that then you have the path and you follow the path. And then the other factors come as a natural consequence of that. Because you have the path in your heart. You know what's going on. You know what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. So you can practice the path fully. So that is the first one there. So the question arises, does it mean that there's no practice without being a stream enter? That's kind of the very first thing you think when you see that. And I think the best answer to that question is found in another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, which does not have this first factor. It does not have abandoning by seeing. It starts off with the second one here, which is abandoning by restraining. And in that case, the path looks a bit different, because then it seems to be talking about an ordinary person, an ordinary worldling, a putujana, who starts by restraining themselves and start practicing the path. And then that leads to awakening eventually. So this is not absolute, that the path all starts absolutely with being a stream mentor. It's just that the full practice of the path starts with a stream mentor. Before that, we're a bit in the dark and we're trying our best. And we're sort of moving in the right direction. So that is the first one there. So once you have seen things, well, then the path happens pretty much automatically. So then the second one is restraining. The restraining, of course, means that you stop yourself from going to those places that are going to lead to suffering and problems for yourself. And then you have the next ones here, the abandoning, enduring and avoiding. These are all pretty much on the same level. And these are about using your requisites and living in such a way that you don't allow negative qualities to arise in the mind. So first of all, you have restrained yourself. And that restraint means that you have allowed the defilements to subside and disappear. This is not suppression. Sometimes you get suppression as being, these things translated as suppression. But usually it's not about suppression. It's a natural abandoning of the defilements that happens as you progress on the path. I'm always a bit afraid of this word suppression, because it sounds like you're using willpower to almost like repress things. And of course, this is one of the things that often leads to problems, according to psychologists, etc. And here then we are first having restrained, then you make sure that you live in such a way that you keep that restraint. You don't allow defilements to arise. This is about using things in the right way, enduring things when you have to, and avoiding things that are best avoided. And then you get the abandoning by removing. And this is like removing the unwholesome states of mind, whatever is left, so that you are ready for deep meditation. So this is the abandoning of or removing of the very last of the hindrances in the mind before samadhi, before meditation becomes possible. The last thing then is the abandoning by development. So once the defilements are completely removed, that is when meditation really takes off. And you sit down, and the abandoning by developing here is defined as the seven bhujangas, the seven factors of enlightenment. And the seven factors of enlightenment, they are like the psychology of meditation. They show you how meditation functions. How, once you sit down and you watch the breath or whatever, what actually happens in your mind when you sit down to meditate. It's a very interesting topic. And it's interesting that the suttas actually has that psychology of meditation. It's right there at the heart of the suttas. And this is what the bhujangas is about. And then as you go through the bhujangas, the mind develops more and more, becomes more and more powerful, until you attain a state of samadhi that is so deep that you are able to see things properly. And then, of course, that ends up with awakening according to the Buddha's teachings. So that is the gradual training. This is quite a unique way of explaining the gradual training. It's only really found in the sutta. And for that reason, I think it's quite interesting. And particularly the first part here is interesting, the abandoning by seeing, because this is explained quite deeply in the sutta. So we now come to the first way of abandoning. It tends to be abandoned by seeing. And please, if you have any questions, please just raise your hand or whatever as we go along. Yeah, question there? No? Oh, you have the microphone. Okay. Okay, very good. Yeah. Okay, so please feel free to ask at any time if you like. Okay. Or if you have any complaints or you want to correct me, that's fine as well. Please do so.
Complaints? Yeah.
I have already explained that in quite detail before you came here. So, yeah, I think I should be okay. Yeah, there it is translated as outflowings, and here it's translated as taints. So, but it's the same word, right? As I explained it initially here. Yeah. Okay. So then we come to the taints or the asavas or the outflowings. Use all the words here to make sure that it's clear here. To be abandoned by seeing. So this is insight, right? Seeing, knowing and seeing is always about insight in the Pali here. So what taints, outflowings, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by seeing? Here, bhikkhus, an untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men, is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he attends to those things unfit for attention, and he does not attend to those things fit for attention. So again, you can see here how this starts off with hearing some good teaching, which helps you to see things in the right way. And it starts off, the untaught ordinary person is like the asuttava putujana. Asuttava means not having heard, because in those days the teachings were oral. So teaching and hearing were the same thing. So you were taught through hearing. So untaught meant here is actually who has not heard. Ordinary putujana literally means many, many folk or many person. So these are the people who are not Aryas, who haven't. That's what it means to see her. So he's someone who doesn't see the noble ones, who doesn't go and visit them and, you know, say hello basically and say, you know, and listen to the Dhamma as it comes next year. Having a regard for somebody, to me, it means something slightly different too. So it actually means it's somebody who doesn't see the noble ones. And because he doesn't see them, he's unskilled. It literally means he's not knowledgeable. Akovido, not knowledgeable. And undisciplined, not trained in their Dhamma. Because he doesn't see them, he doesn't get to hear the Dhamma. And because he doesn't get to hear the Dhamma, he doesn't have a chance to train, right? You can see the gradual progression there. You don't see. Because you don't see, you don't hear. And because you don't hear, you don't get trained. If you see, there's a chance that you will hear. And then there's a chance you might train. So there's a sequence again going on. Very Buddhist thing to have these sequences of things, one leading to the next. And then you have the same thing. It's called true men here. Well, I think it would be more appropriate. Men is not really required because it said true person. And true here, the word here is sapurisa. And sa basically means like good, a good person. So it means somebody who, you know, who has some special qualities in them. And this is a synonym with Arya, which we saw before. Synonym with noble one. Noble one and the sapurisa, true person, these are synonyms. And again, for those of you who haven't heard this before, this is very typical of the Pali suttas, that they repeat things and they use synonyms all the way throughout. And the reason for that, again, is because it is originally an oral literature. And in oral literature, you repeat things, you use synonyms, because it stabilizes the text. If you have one word and it goes a bit awry because somebody mishears or whatever, then you have a problem. But if you have lots of synonyms, it stabilizes the contents, because it's much less likely to actually lose the meaning in that way. So this is one of the results of it being oral literature. So because of that, because you have no regard for these things, you don't understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Because you don't understand that, you go around attending to those things that are unfit for attention, and those things fit for attention, you don't actually attend to. And again, fit for attention here means, it's important to understand what this means. This is not some kind of doctrine or dogma that this is fit, this is not fit. This is basically whatever leads to happiness and contentment and peace for yourself and others, that is what is fit for attention. That's what is meant by fit here. And unfit means things that in the long run leads to suffering for yourself and for others. It's not a dogma. It's basically a practical example of what we're all searching for, which is happiness. It's an example of how to attain that, basically. Yeah. And this is what is to be expected. If you aren't taught some more profound teaching, of course you go out into the world. On the surface, it looks like we've got to go out and enjoy ourselves, right? We've got to party, we've got to have a good time, we've got to indulge, we've got to do all kinds of things, and we've got to mess around in the world. That's how it often feels on the surface, you know, when you grow up as a young person. That's what it seems like. And it often takes a bit of reflection. It takes hearing some good teachings to actually remind you, maybe there is something more to life than these superficial things. Maybe there are other things that actually are much more important for your happiness than these surface things. And initially, when we start off on a spiritual path, these two worlds kind of clash a little bit, right? On the one hand, we recognize that it's important to do good, to be good people, and we understand somehow that this is going to create happiness for ourselves and others. But at the same time, we also have an interest in worldly things, of course. So we have both. It's not like an absolute opposition between the two. We just start off, and the two we go together for a while, and then gradually we move more and more towards the side of doing those things that are fit for attention and less of those other ones. It's a gradual movement, and it happens by itself as you practice in the right way, as you reflect in the right way. It's not something you force, not something that you make life miserable for yourself because you force these things. It's a natural movement that pretty much happens by itself. Okay, so now comes the question, well, what are these things that are unfit for attention? And so the Buddha says, what are those things unfit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire arises in him, and the arisen outflowing of sensual desire increases. The unarisen taint of existence, arises in him, and the arisen taint of existence increases. The unarisen taint of ignorance arises in him, and the arisen taint of ignorance increases. These are the things unfit for attention that he attends to. So, the taint here, or the asava, or the outflowing of sensual desire, this is basically when the mind goes out into the world, goes out into the objects of the senses, and you feel desire for the objects of the senses, right? That's what that is about. And so when you attend to the objects of the senses in the wrong way, desire arises. So what is that wrong way of attending to the senses of the object? Do you know what that is? This is described also in the suttas. And the wrong way is to... The ideal way of attending to the objects of the senses is to not see them as inherently happy, but to understand the disadvantage as well of the objects of the senses. So if you think that the senses are going to give you happiness in a different way from what they actually are going to give you, if you don't see the full picture of what's going on, that is when the mind goes out and you actually crave for these things. So you're seeing the beauty, so to speak, in the objects of the senses, and you forget the disadvantage. When you find the balance point where you don't just see the beauty, but you remember the disadvantage as well, or the danger as well, then you get a balanced approach, and you don't actually have the craving anymore for the sense desire. You use them in a more neutral way. So that is what is meant here for attending to them in the wrong way. You think that there is some happiness there, which according to the Buddha actually isn't there. He says the danger is much greater. And the unarisen taint of existence of being, this is much more profound. It is relatively easy to see how the sensory world is not as happy as we might think it is initially, that it leads to all kind of problems sometimes, to cravings and to conflicts and all kind of things that the sensory world leads to. So there is certainly a lot of danger and disadvantage there. But this being or existence is a much more profound kind of a taint or outflowing or asava. And this is actually It's not so much that existence in itself is an outflow of being, but it's the desire for existence that this actually refers to. So I think Ajahn Nisro has a translation, becoming, which it shows you more. Becoming is like the desire for existence, right? The moving towards something in the future. And so what is going on here is that you desire to exist now, because your desire to exist now comes from a sense of self, right? I am, I want to exist. You also want to exist in the future. And in that sense, you are like, it's like you're projecting yourself into the future. That desire is also what keeps you going at the same time. You're projecting yourself into the future in a sense. And the last one is the taint of ignorance. And this is like the most, kind of the root taint or the root outflowing. And this is, of course, not seeing the Four Noble Truths, not seeing non-self, not seeing things in the wrong way, not seeing things in accordance with reality, in a very deep sense, is what is meant by this one. That also keeps you going, because it means that you act in the wrong way, you have craving, where actually there's no grounds for having craving. So, whenever you think in a certain way, and you see that you have desire for existence, you have desire for sensory objects, or you see that your kind of delusion and your ignorance increases. In other words, you have a stronger sense of self, you see things as more permanent, and you see happiness where perhaps there isn't any. Then you know that you are attending in the wrong way, because you actually, these taints are increasing inside of you. Yes?
But is it a package deal with that? So, for example, I have got this real addiction to lovely milk, Belgian chocolate, and I just really feel wonderful when I have a half a bar of Belgian chocolate. Am I going to lock in an increased sense of self / existence with that, and all the other two? In other words, does one beget the other? And the other two, if I go for the Belgian chocolate and I don't think about the calories it's going to put on my and my fluctuations in blood sugar, I just think about how yummy it tastes, is the asa of existence going to be fired up, and is the asa of delusion going to be fired up purely by the fact that I go for the asa of sensory desire? Is each of them contained in the other, or are they separate, or can it be a variation of both?
They depend on each other. They are interlinked. So, for example, if you have a lot of craving for Belgian chocolate or whatever, then you would want to exist in the future because you want to experience that more, right? You want this. This is something beautiful in the world, something wonderful in the world, an existence. The reason that you want to exist is because you want to be happy. Now, Belgian chocolate makes you happy, so you want to exist in the future. And the same thing with ignorance, because what you're doing here is that you're bringing up a defilement inside of yourself. Now, if you have a strong desire in you, that desire makes you not see things properly. So you actually, ignorance is actually increasing at the point when you have strong desire for things. So you, this is one of the suttas in Anguttara Nikaya where it says explicitly that the support for ignorance is the five hindrances. So if you increase your craving, if you make craving worse, you're actually making ignorance worse as well. And by making ignorance worse, the whole causality chain of dependent origination makes everything worse, including suffering. But I think an important point I want to make here is that things like this should happen naturally. You shouldn't go home and think, oh, I mustn't enjoy the Belgian chocolate because that is, that is a kind of a bad thing or something like that. If you crave Belgian chocolate, well, you crave it. And, it's just because you can't see properly. So if you have that craving and you indulge that craving at the time, it's not necessarily a very bad thing, because the craving is already there and it's not going to change the matter all that much whether you have the chocolate or not. The point, rather, is that outside, when you don't have that craving, when you practice the Dhamma, you actually reflect on the disadvantages of Belgian chocolate. Belgian chocolate is not the worst thing. It's a pretty kind of, it's not really, really bad one. But for a monastic, you think about the disadvantage of relationships, Okay, if you as a monastic have too much attraction to the opposite gender or whatever, it's going to be a problem for you. It's not going to work. So you have to reflect on that. And gradually you move away from that. And the same thing with Belgian chocolate. It's not so much that you, when you reflect on it outside and you see the danger of the craving actually gradually subsides. And you can still eat that Belgian chocolate, but the craving actually is less. And in one way, that actually enhances the taste of the chocolate, funnily enough. This is actually one of the suttas also in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha says that when you come out of a deep samadhi state and you get like some old broken rice and some dodgy food and some, you know, patchy robes or whatever, and a kind of, you know, dwelling at the root of a tree, all of those things seem like royal requisites to you, like the requisites of a king, because the purity of your mind means that you're able to enjoy them fully 100%. The craving actually detracts from the enjoyment of the thing in the first place. So if you have less craving, in one way you actually enjoy it more. But because you have become a purer person, because your mind is more at ease, because you develop the path, it doesn't catch you so much when you eat it.
Okay, but what I was really alluding to there is that if you give way to addictions of one form or another, is that going to increase the second asava existence by way of increasing narcissism? In other words, the more addicted I am, the more determined I am to do my own thing, have my own way, and not give a damn about other people. Yeah, the whole package that goes with narcissism, you know, I'm the center of the universe, all of that sort of stuff. Yeah. Does that follow on as an increase, as an automatic increase from things like addictions?
But is addictions and narcissism addiction?
No, they're not the same.
No,
the question is, does one beget the other? In other words, if I'm so into getting my next cocaine fix or chocolate fix, you know, whatever it is, a serious addiction I'm talking about, you know, what I've seen with people is that people who are seriously addicted to things, they don't give a stuff about anyone else. What they want is what they want, and the world can go to hell.
Right.
Now, that's narcissism. Is that an expression of the second asava? It's all about me. My existence is paramount.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all about me.
Right.
Do you understand my question?
I think so, yes. Yeah, I think I do. I think the problem with addiction like that is that you... I think the reason why you couldn't give a stuff about the rest of the world is simply because, you know, it's because of the addiction, isn't it, basically? It's because of this thing. The craving is so incredibly strong that you just can't... That this becomes the be-all and end-all in life because the craving is so powerful. And it... you know probably much more about this than I do, Chris, but I suspect the reason why people get addicted is because they have suffering in their life, that this life is empty, it's meaningless, and you need something to fill the gap. And I guess the kind of very powerful craving maybe actually leads to a sense of, I guess it does lead to a sense of self, doesn't it? Because this becomes what is important. This is actually what matters.
Is there a sub-asava or within the category of existence? Is there a non-existence? In other words,
tanha, part of craving. Tanha, vibhava tanha. It's not asava, it's called tanha, craving. Yeah. So you have the desire for not to exist, the desire to be annihilated.
Because you get that oftentimes when you get people that are really addicted and then they just so into their trip.
Yeah.
And then they'll just, it'll flick, and they'll just be incredibly self-sabotaging and, you know, suicidal and all that sort of stuff.
Right, yeah.
Is that an expression of the thwarted, you know, the thwarted sense of self?
I guess.
Thwarted sense of the asura of existence.
Right, yeah. I'm not really sure if I can actually answer those questions, because I'm not sure. It seems like I'm going to need to reflect on those things a little bit rather than answer off the top of my head. I might just say something silly here.
Okay, thank you.
So, but yeah. But, okay. Okay, so let's move on. Problems in life. And what are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of sensual desire is abandoned. The unarisen taint of existence does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of existence or of desire for existence is abandoned. The unarisen taint of ignorance does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of ignorance is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to. By attending to these things unfit for attention, and by not attending to things fit for attention, both unarisen taints arise in him, and arisen taints increase. So, again, you can see part of the gradual path, even just in this little thing here, where it talks about, first of all, that you avoid the taint arising. In other words, you avoid the arising of sensual desire. And then after avoiding the arising of it, then you abandon it as the next one, next step. And the same thing for all three. You avoid the arising of ignorance. In other words, you avoid making it worse by allowing the hindrances to arise, and then eventually you abandon it. So again, you can see the gradualness of the training there. So these things have to come in the right order again. And now comes the interesting part here, because now it comes, well, how is it that he attends unwisely? And the interesting thing here, I just mentioned before that one way of attending unwisely is to see the beauty, for example, in a sensory object where perhaps there isn't that beauty. You see some, it's like wishful thinking. But actually here, what we'll see here is that the entire attending unwisely is termed or is phrased in terms of the self, in terms of the I. It's all about reflections on me and who I am. And that's very interesting, because what that actually means is that the root problem, the root kind of wrong attending, is the attending when you see, you make a self out of something which actually is not the self. And that is what is going on here. And once you see non-self, then you can abandon things like desire and ill will and ignorance. It has to be in the right sequence, because the root problem is precisely the sense of I that you have inside. And this is what happens when we have a sense of I. This is how you attend unwisely. And what you think is, was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So you can see here how all this revolves around the sense of I, right? So you have you come into this world with the sense of I. That's part and parcel of what it means to be a human being. There's a feeling inside, I exist, right? We all have that. There's a feeling of I inside. And because you have that feeling, that expresses itself in the inquiries about who am I actually? Okay, I feel I exist, but who actually am I here? And this is a sort of inquiry that people tend to make. Maybe not fully consciously, but subconsciously often. We have ideas, we have theories, we take up ideas in the world. And if you feel that I'm going to exist forever, for example, it says here that, you know, what shall I be in the future? Then you might take up Christianity and say, okay, yeah, when I die, I will go to God and whatever, and I will exist, you know, or with Brahma or God or whatever, and I will exist there forever with God. Because there's something inside of you which makes you feel right, that feels right to you. So you go in that direction. And if you think about the past here, for example, was I in the past? You may think perhaps about rebirth, about the cycle of samsara, how things have been going on, and how you have been moving around. And part of this might actually be ideas such as rebirth and karma might also come in under this, how you sort of transmigrate through samsara. So these are essentially just different ways of thinking about yourself, being concerned about yourself because you feel that there is something there. You have, am I, am I not? This is a bit like, in other words, do I have a soul or don't I have a soul? Will I be everlasting or not? This is what that is about. So then when you speculate in this way, and then you give rise to views. And this is what comes next to the kind of views that arise from this kind of speculation. You can see here what's happening here. What's happening is that, first of all, You have a sense inside, I exist, I am something here. Then craving arises because you feel that, you feel you exist, but somehow it all seems so slippery. It seems like you can't really grasp hold onto what it actually is you are, which makes sense from a Buddhist point of view because everything is impermanent, everything is always changing. So of course it's a bit slippery here. There isn't really anything to grasp onto here. And because of that, you get a bit desperate. Craving arises, tries to kind of tries to, you know, settle things, to sort of pinpoint who you actually are. And this is what craving does. It starts thinking like this. And then eventually, you then come to the view. And that is what is happening next here. So when he attends unwisely in this way, one of six views arises in him. The view, the self exists for me, arises in him as true and established. Or the view, no self exists for me, arises in him as true and established. Or the view, I perceive self with self, arises in him as true and established. Or else he has some such view as this. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad action. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. This speculative view, bhikkhus, is called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught worldling is not freed from birth, old age, and death. From sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, he is not freed from suffering, I say. So these are the views that arise in you when you start to speculate about who you are. And the point of these views here, I don't think it matters all that much exactly how these are supposed to be understood. I will look at that in a second, but I don't think it matters all that much. The main point is just that in whatever way you conceive of the self, and it doesn't matter, even if it wasn't included in this list, in whatever way you conceive of the self, that is the problem. That is what this is supposed to be like, an all-encompassing net, if you like, of all possible ways of perceiving a self. So this is what it really is about. And the first one here is the self exists for me, arises in him as true and established. And this is the eternalist view we have in Buddhism. We talk about this is the eternalist view, the sasataditti, as it's called in Pali. And this is the idea that when you die, the self is there. And even before maybe you got born into this life, the self was there. You existed all this time. This is the sasataditti. This is like the view you have perhaps in Christianity or in most kind of theistic religions. You have this idea of something which has always been there, or at least it was perhaps created by a god, and then it will exist ever after that in some sort of existence. And that is like one extreme, according to Buddhism, the eternalist view. Now, the other thing here is no self exists for me. Now, this is a bit tricky, because you might think that this is the Buddhist teachings, right? It sounds like Buddhism. No self exists for me. But actually, no, this is not what it means. This is actually refers to the annihilist idea of a self, the Uccedavada. And the Uccedavada is the idea that when you die, you will get annihilated. And the reason is why it is not a Buddhist point of view is because we all have a sense of self inside. And that, not all, but most of us have a sense of self inside. And that self is what you think will be annihilated when you die. This is equivalent to the modern materialist point of view. When you die, everything just stops, and that's the end of it. That's the Uccedavada, and that's the other side of the equation in Buddhism. And the reason I can say I know that this is what it means is because it's clearly defined as such in other places in the suttas, in the Samyutta Nikaya. This actually refers to the Uccedavada. It does not refer to the Buddhist position. And the Buddha speaks as a very nice sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Nidana Samyutta, called the, what is it called again now? Kacchanagotta Sutta, which is talks about the Dhamma as the middle way between the Uccedavada and the Sasatavada. It is neither, because the world, as it says in the Sutta, the world tends to two extremes, either to the view of annihilation, which is the modern view that almost many people in the world have, when you die, that's the end of it, or the world tends to the other extreme, which is the Sāsvatavāda, eternalism, which is very common in many religions. But the Buddha says, in Buddhism, it's the middle way between these things. Things are not eternal. Things do not end at death. There is causality. Causality, and he says in that sutta, when you see the arising of things, then you know there cannot be annihilation. Because you understand arising, you understand causality. If you understand causality, you know that there cannot be an ending when you die. So understanding causality is a clue to understanding that things must move on after you die. But because you understand cessation, you know it cannot be eternal. There can be no eternalism. So causality is the clue concept in Buddhism that explains how things can go on, neither as eternal nor as annihilation. And this causality is of course dependent origination. And that dependent origination is what you see when you become a Sotapanna, a stream entry. That's when you see that for the first time fully. You understand arising and you understand the cessation of things. So this is the problem. And these are the two kind of extremes that people tend to go to in the world. Those views then become established as true. Or they become arise in him as true and established. Just means that you take it as this is the reality. And that becomes a view. And very often it becomes a very powerful view. And you know what it's like. Once you have a view about something, you tend to grasp onto it. That view may come from past lives. It may come from your upbringing. It may come from all these kind of things. And because it is so strongly conditioned in you, it is very, very hard to give it up. And the Buddha actually says that also in the Sutta, that sometimes people with strong views, they are trapped by those views. They can't go beyond them because the view is so, so strong in them. So we have to be careful as Buddhists not to be trapped by our Buddhist views, because it can be a similar kind of trap, right? Particularly if you think you understand the Buddha's teachings, but perhaps you don't fully understand what's going on. It's always good to have an open mind and say, okay, I'm inquiring into this. I have a preliminary view that maybe that there is rebirth and these things, but let me not pretend that I actually know this. Let it be a preliminary thing that I'm working with. I think that is a more honest way of looking at the world, because you don't actually know. That's the reality of it. So then he goes on, and then he has these other views of self that he also talks about here. I perceive self with self. And this, I think, basically means that the things that you see inside of yourself, that thing which perceives, that is also yourself. So you perceive with something, and that is also yourself. So you perceive the self with the self. The self perceives itself, in a sense. Perception or consciousness perceives itself. So the perception is the self. And then you have, he perceives not self with self. So what this means is that the self is one thing, and what you perceive inside of you, like your consciousness perhaps, or your feelings or whatever, that's something else. So the self is something which stands apart from you, and then it sees everything, and all the things that always are changing inside of you, these are the things that the self sees. But the self sort of stands back a little bit and sees all these things. And this is one of the kind of theories that you find at the time of the Buddha. People had all these theories about the self, the soul, what it actually is. And this was one of those theories that the Buddha refuted. Or this can also be understood to mean that you divide your personality or your khandhas into groups. Some of them are the self, and the other ones are not the self. And then you perceive all this non-self stuff with the self part. And then you have the other one here. I perceive non-self with self. That was what I just said. I perceive self with non-self. So this means that your perception, that which perceives, is non-self. But then you see other things which you take to be self. For example, you take your feelings to be self, and you perceive your feelings with your consciousness. So the consciousness is the self, and then you perceive this other thing. Sorry, the consciousness is the non-self, and then you perceive the feelings with that non-self. Something like that. That's a little bit strange, but it's something like that. I think the idea is to include all possible ways in which a self can be expressed philosophically. So that's kind of the idea with this. I wouldn't worry too much about these things. The idea is just that this includes all ideas of how a self relates to you as a person, relates to the five khandhas. How can a self relate to the five khandhas? And then the last one here is quite interesting. The last one is a view such as this arises. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. And this here is very similar to the kind of view that you found at the time of the Buddha. If you read the ancient Brahmin texts at those days, like the Upanishads, in particular Upanishads, is like the Brahmanical text that came into being roughly around the time of the Buddha. And these are the sort of statements that you see in those texts. This is myself, the one that speaks and feels and experiences these things. So the importance of this statement then is that here the Buddha is directly counteracting the philosophical ideas of his own time. He was saying that, well, these views that are current now, these are not correct according to the Buddha's understanding of reality here. Which is quite nice, because sometimes you can see how the Buddha fitted into a particular culture, a particular time in history, right? And he had to answer to the questions that were relevant in those days. And that is what he's doing here, because this was kind of one of those ideas that was current at that time. And it's important to understand that the Buddha also is conditioned by his environment, right? He has to respond to the environment he is in. He has to respond in the language that is used in that time. And because he responds and he uses that language, sometimes when you read the scriptures of the Brahmins of that time, you can see how it actually matches with what the Buddha is saying, because he's responding to their claims and to their ideas, which is interesting here. And so what are they saying? What is this view? And you can see here, the self of mine is that which speaks. So in other words, it's the agent inside, the will, the doer inside of you. That is what he's saying is the self. That which feels and experiences. In other words, it is the feelings, it is the perception and the consciousness. So basically, he's saying the mind is myself, or at least certain aspects of the mind. Maybe not the whole mind, but certain aspects of the mind, which is able to do these things and experience these things. And then this self, this is that which is permanent, eternal, everlasting, etc., and will endure as long as eternity. So you can see here how this fits very closely with the Buddha's idea of the khandhas. And it's possible that the reason why the Buddha did describe his own teaching in terms of the five khandhas, one reason might be precisely because, well, this is how people, if people say there is a self, you can see that here, they always speak in terms of volition, will, feeling, experiences, right? And this is exactly how the Buddha then counteracts. Actually, there is no self there. Yes.
Ajahn from Mali, I just had a question in regards to the self, and sometimes people ask me this question when they find out that I might be a Buddhist. What's the best way to describe what it is that is traversing through the potential of reincarnation if it's not a self, if it's not sort of a personality, I guess?
Yeah.
This is a question I get asked all the time.
Sure.
When I go to the prison, actually.
Okay.
And I'm not an expert, so I
think
there's a more concise answer.
Yeah. Well, this is actually one of the difficult things about Buddhism, because this is what makes, in a sense, Buddhism so kind of different from all other religions. Is other religions that say, well, there's a self there, and this self is what goes through samsara and experiences all these things. But Buddhism says you don't actually need a self to be reborn. All you need is craving. And craving is actually sufficient to actually give rise to you know, a new existence in the future. It's like craving is almost like it projects you into the future because you want to exist, and that desire drives you on in the future. The Buddha calls craving the moisture. In other words, the moisture is like the sap, the nourishment that is required for something to re-arise in the future again. So you don't actually need, the Buddha says, a permanent self to re-arise in the future. It's a stream of things that it's a stream of consciousness, he says, that goes from one life to another one. So it is connected. It's not a completely disconnected sequence. It is connected. The things are connected to each other, and that's why when you, if you ever were to remember a past life, you would recognize yourself. That's me in the past life. And the reason you can see that is because there is a connection. Your personality then is not completely dissociated from who you are now. There's a connection all the way through. That's how we can recognize it. There's a stream of consciousness, and there's an ever-changing stream which is always changing. So in one sense, there is a you which is always changing. It's not like you become somebody completely different, but also you're not the same. And one simple way of thinking about that is thinking about yourself in this life. You know, you now compared to you, who you were 10 years ago, is it the same person or is it a different person?
Totally different. Or almost.
Yeah.
Very different.
But there's continuity, right? You yes. weren't somebody else either. You know, you weren't like Venerable Buddha Rakita. There's continuity and there is change. And it's exactly the same thing as happening across rebirth. So all that happens is that, well, the body dies and the mind, but the mind is still there. Just like the mind is there now, moving along, the mind just continues.
So potentially, does that mean that if you had cravings in this lifetime, that they could have been in the past as well, you know, smoking or alcohol or whatever?
Yeah.
It can just continue on and on.
Precisely. Yeah. And this is one of the things which is you know, why you want to practice as much as you can do in this life, because the habits that you have, you tend to carry them with you from life to life. Your personality changes, but it's only gradually and slowly. And I think that is actually, you know, some of the people ask, what about alcohol? You know, I'm happy to keep the four precepts, but the fifth one is a bit difficult. Because there's a lot of social pressure in society. Not only in Australia, but I think everywhere in the world, there's a lot of social pressure to drink. Because that's such a big thing, social thing. And people want to do that, you know, and they think, why should I stop drinking? And I think it is fair to say, among the five precepts, on its own, drinking is kind of the least bad one. But the problem is that it tends to bring with it all kinds of other actions. But the other thing is that, just what you're saying now, because you have a habit of drinking, it is a habit that you bring with you into a future life. And then the drinking is one of these things that it tends to go up. You know, you tend to drink rather more and more rather than going down. And these two things together, that it tends to increase, particularly if you start to get addicted to it, obviously, and the fact that you're bringing a habit with you, that is what makes it a bit frightening, you know. And next life, Maybe you know, you get into the wrong company, or you don't have any good guidance around to tell that this is dangerous, and then it really takes off, you know. So it's always good to sort of take a very long term view on these things. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm just going to finish off the taint of seeing today. I hope you don't mind. If you have to go, please do so. Don't feel embarrassed about going. You can leave at any time. Because otherwise I will feel bad about it. I can't go through this. So then he says that this is this speculative view. I think this is dittigata in Pali. Actually, I think I have the Pali here. Let's have a look. Dittigata, which literally means he has gone to view or acquired a view. Whatever, it doesn't matter. It's good, clear enough, I think. So he has this speculative view. It's called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a vacillation of views, a fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person is not freed from birth, aging, and death, etc. So the problem here is that once you have that view, then it becomes impossible to go to the end of the Buddhist path. This blocks you. And that's why it's called the fetter of views, because it binds you to samsara. And this is the thing, that if you think that, you know, the mind is going to go on, or the soul is going to go on for eternity, if that view is strong, then you will not investigate whether the five khandhas are impermanent. And if you don't investigate that, you can never make that breakthrough and that understanding. So this holds you on to the world. And the stronger that view is, the more troublesome it is, and the less that, you know, the less chance you are for having to, less chance you have of making the breakthrough. And this is, of course, also why that sometimes you find people in all kinds of religions, they may have a deep experience of meditation, but because they are committed to a certain view, they will actually see that meditation state in terms of that view. So, you know, you get a very deep meditation and you think, oh, union with God or whatever. This is kind of a classical result of having a very deep meditation if you are if you believe in a God. So the where you're coming from is actually very important. And that is the reason why the Noble Eightfold Path always starts with right view. And Sammasamadhi, the real deep samadhi, is only called Sammasamadhi if it is based on right view. If it is not based on right view, Sammasamadhi doesn't actually lead to enlightenment. It only leads to there, and then it stops there. It can't take you any further. Of course, that's wonderful in its own right. I mean, it's great to reach that sort of state of samadhi. But if you take the Buddha's teaching seriously, you want to go even beyond that. So, because of that, you are not freed from suffering, the Buddha says. You keep on going round and round, birth, aging and death, and sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, although you might have a nice little holiday in a nice realm somewhere. Yeah. So, that is what happens to the untaught, ordinary person, the putujana, the ordinary worldling. Yeah. So then comes the contrast, and the contrast is with the well-taught noble disciple, which comes next year. So the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, who has regard for good people and is superior people, and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, and he attends to those things fit for attention. So here you have the well-taught noble disciple who does see the noble ones, who understands the Dhamma, and who is disciplined. He has trained himself in that Dhamma. And so the well-taught noble disciple then usually means the Arya, the one who has seen the Dhamma, who has seen the teaching of the Buddha directly through his own insight. And again, you can see here how there's almost like a bit of a gap here. There's a gap because the previous person was the untaught person, and suddenly you jump straight from the untaught person to the one who is a noble disciple, who has profound insight. What about all those in between? You know, you think they were like few in between who have heard the teaching, what kind of trying and sort of, you know, on the path, etc. And again, for that reason, you can see here how these words both have an absolute sense and a relative sense. So in the absolute sense, the noble, well-taught disciple is somebody who is an Arya, because then you definitely are a noble disciple. You definitely are, you know, well, you definitely have heard the teachings fully because you've understood them for yourself. And then all those in between who are beginning, you know, who are starting to get an understanding of these teachings. They're not an Arya yet, not a noble person yet, but they are leaning in that direction. So they are like a little bit noble, if you like, and they have been taught a little bit. So that is in the relative sense, people who are practicing the right way also come under this term, but they haven't gone quite that far again. So again, these things have to be seen as having these two meanings, the relative and the absolute meaning here. And then, because of that, then, because you go and see the noble ones and the superior people, and because of that you hear and you understand the teachings and you train accordingly, because of that you understand what is fit for attention and what isn't. And then you practice accordingly, right? And then gradually it goes this way. And again, you can see here, if you reflect on that, you can see how the relative and absolute issues come in here. Because, of course, for somebody who is an Arya, they will always know what is fit for attention and what isn't. As soon as they reflect, they will know it straight away here because they have seen the teachings. For the rest of us, sometimes we know, sometimes we don't. We're still struggling a little bit. So there is that, again, relative and absolute distinction there. So, and then it largely repeats itself, but I'll just go through this fairly quickly. So what are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to? They are the things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire arises in him. And the unarisen taint of sensual desire and the arisen taint of sensual desire increases. And then you have the same with the taint of existence. It increases or arises. And the same thing with the taint of ignorance. It either increases or arises. These are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to. And what are the things fit for attention that he does attend to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint or asava of sensual desire does not arise in him. And the arisen taint of sensual desire is abandoned. And then the same thing for the taint of existence and the taint of ignorance. These are the things fit for attention that he attends to. By not attending to things unfit for attention, and by attending to things fit for attention, unarisen asavas, outflowing taints, do not arise in him, and the arisen taints are abandoned. So the opposite of what is before her. And then comes how he attends wisely. So remembering before, the attending unwisely was thinking in terms of an I. Do I exist? Who am I? You know, this kind of existential angst, you know, you feel that you exist, but you can't really pin it down, and you get this kind of fear inside of yourself. Who am I actually? So all of that tends to solidify the sense of the self. But this is then how you actually do attend wisely. This is the opposite. Instead of solidifying a sense of self, you're actually looking at things as they actually are. And this is how he does that. This is suffering. He attends wisely. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him. Personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So here, instead of actually assuming there is a self, instead of taking, you know, I exist, and then trying to speculate about it in all kind of ways and making up all kind of theories, instead of doing that, he's actually looking at himself objectively, the kind of looking you do after a deep state of samadhi. You come out, and then you see, it's all impermanent, it's all suffering, there's nothing to hold on to. There isn't anything in here which I can really call a self, right? When everything is impermanent and everything is suffering, everything is always changing, then the idea of a self becomes impossible, because the self, by definition, is something which is permanent and usually something which also is happiness. So this is how you do it. You see things properly. This is suffering. And this is the exact opposite of looking for the self. And one way which I remember Ajahn Brahm used to teach before, he hasn't said it for quite a while, but instead of saying the question, who am I, which the unwise person is saying here, the better question is to ask, who do I take myself to be? Because when you ask yourself, who do I take myself to be, you're actually inquiring, well, let's see, who do I think I am? And then I will look at that and see if it is really worthy of being called a self. So if you think, you know, if you sit down and you meditate and your mind is very pure and very powerful, you ask yourself, who do I take myself to be? And maybe you take yourself to be your consciousness. Well, then you investigate that consciousness. Is it really worthy of being called a self? And this is in how you can make a breakthrough in this way. When you see it's not worthy of being taken as a self, then you become eventually a stream entry. And then when you gain that stream entry, actually, before I say that, I should say that there are four things he attends wisely. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Well, these are just four aspects of the same thing. They're not really four different wise attentions, they're just the same thing, basically, because these things arise together. When you understand that there is suffering, you also understand its cause, you understand its cessation, and you understand the path. They're all part of the same insight. And then you abandon the three fetters. And these are the three fetters of that the stream mentor has abandoned. Personality view. Personality view just means that you think that there is a self in there. You think that there is a self in consciousness, in perception, in feelings or whatever. And that is the personality view. Not only do you think it, but you feel it for yourself, right? This is actually one of the quite interesting things which I think is quite important. Sometimes you will read that, you know, philosophers or psychologists will say, well, there is no self inside of us. We all know that because we can never see any self. And that is true, but that is an intellectual level, right? You cannot see it intellectually. But there still is a feeling inside of you that I exist, I am somebody. And that is the problem. That feeling is actually what you want to overcome. And even if intellectually you know that there is no self or whatever, the feeling is still there. So the problem still exists. There still is a sense of self inside. And it's that sense of self that we want to overcome. And that is what we're overcoming here. We're overcoming this. We no longer have the view in a very personal sense that I exist inside. That is what is disappearing here. It's not the intellectual view of the philosopher. It's a very immediate personal experience that we're talking about here. And you also abandon doubt. And of course, the reason that you abandon doubt is that you have seen the Dhamma. And you have seen the path. You know what it's all about. In the suttas, doubt is defined as doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. You no longer have any doubt. You know exactly what you have to do. What leads towards Nibbana? What does not lead towards Nibbana? Doubt has been abandoned. Before that, we are still kind of struggling a bit sometimes to know what is right, what is wrong. We always think, you know, what is actually the moral thing to do in this case? We don't really feel sure about ourselves, often because we are not clear about our intentions, perhaps, you know. All these complicated issues about euthanasia and abortion and difficult ethical dilemmas very often is because our intentions aren't very clear, and that's why it's very hard to know sometimes, and we need guidelines. But once you become a stream mentor, you have no doubt anymore. You know, you see exactly what is wholesome and unwholesome. It's all to do with your intention. So that is the meaning of doubt, and that's quite important. This is vicikicca in Pali. People are often confused about what doubt means. But that is really all it means, that you're confused about what is actually wholesome, what is, in other words, good and what is bad, basically. And the last one is the adherence to rules and observances. Rules here is sila in Pali, observances is vatta, sila vatta paramasa. And observances is this idea that by, you know, doing certain observances, certain prostrations, or, you know, even keeping certain kind of rules in my life, that will lead to purification in its own right. And part of that you see in the suttas. You had people who had there's a famous cow or the ox duty ascetic in the suttas, and it's the idea that if I act like an ox for the rest of my life, and he literally acted like an ox, he walked around on four legs, and he would eat off the ground, and he would do everything like an ox. And then he thought, well, by acting like an ox, I would purify myself. This was kind of the idea that people had. And this is like, and I think even today you can see people doing things, you know, that they think will purify them. Just by doing actions, external actions, will actually lead to purification. And of course, that was very much the Brahmanical idea at the time of the Buddha. The Brahmins were the masters of ritual, right? And you had to perform the rituals in certain specified ways. And if you didn't perform them in certain specified ways, then the rituals didn't work. And that's why the Brahmins were the priestly caste. And that's why the Brahmins were so powerful, because they were the only ones who knew these rituals. It was a very closely guarded secret. They couldn't give it out. If they gave it out, anybody could perform the rituals. So this is part of that, the Buddha changing the idea of ethics. Ethics is no longer about rituals, it's about intention instead. So rules and rituals, or even precepts and observances, holding on to that is not going to lead to awakening, is the other thing that you see. It's about internal purification that is important. So, these are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So, that is, we've gone on for about an hour and a half. So that's plenty, plenty, plenty. I knew this was going to take quite a while, so I was sort of prepared for that. Is there any last questions before we... Yes, John? John, just hold on a second. Take this.
Rules and rituals heeding to, how could you apply it to modern day Buddhism?
To what? Sorry?
Rules and rituals, you know, yeah. Holding on to rules and rituals.
Yeah.
How can you, you quoted in the time of the Buddha, but how do you see it right here and now?
Well, there's many ways. One of them is just, you know, you hold on to certain, certain kind of precepts even, you know, whatever precept it is. You know, if I just, you know, keep on, it could even be the five precepts of a Buddhist. You know, you kind of hold on to them in the wrong way, grasping onto them, thinking that this is going to be the solution to the spiritual life in its own right. And if you think that if I just do this precept, that's actually sufficient, and you don't actually go beyond that. It's just the precepts are a foundation. They're not actually the end of the path, right? Or it's a bit like perhaps, I mean, maybe in Christianity you have the Ten Commandments. You follow the Ten Commandments, you know, as to the maximum of your ability, thinking this will lead to my rebirth in heaven, and then I'll be happy forever after, that kind of thing. You know, the idea that this is sufficient. So even sila, in a sense of the precepts, is actually included here. Huh? So, and this is the thing about the Arians. You see that the stream enter is said he has virtue, but it doesn't hold on to him. Doesn't hold on to it. It's the word paramasa is used. Paramasa means to hold or grasp onto something. Huh? And the stream mentor, he has virtue, but he doesn't paramasa, he doesn't grasp onto it. This is what is meant. So he has a natural virtue rather than something which grasps because you are, you know, coming from fear or whatever it is. Yeah.
So it's reliance on something outside rather than internal purification. Is that all like?
Yeah, I suppose it is. I suppose maybe it is that, you know, you by doing some certain rituals or whatever, you are maybe you're going to satisfy some kind of god or something like that, and that god will sort of help you if you follow certain rituals. But it may be not just that. It may also be the idea. I think one of the things that, you know, is very typical in religion is that people see the body as evil, right? Because the body is, you know, it's all about craving and desires, all these kind of things. And because the body is all about craving, it must be an evil thing. Yeah? And that's where I think all this self-mortification comes about, you know. And you see self-mortification in so many places. You see that obviously in India in those days. You see it also in Christianity, you know, the self-flagellation and these things that you, you know, I recently heard about somebody who, even today, they probably do that in certain Catholic monasteries, self-flagellation, where they actually, you know, whip themselves. You think that that's a way of, you know, getting rid of sin or whatever. And it seems to be so common. And you see that, I think you see that in Buddhism as well sometimes. You hear about, you know, sometimes people go on retreats. And they say, well, you just sit with the pain. And by sitting with the pain for long periods of time, you're burning off bad karma. That is sometimes the teaching you hear in Buddhist circles. It's not Buddhist, it's not in the suttas though. This is not how the Buddha said we should practice. And I think that is also this, you know, idea that somehow you purify yourself by torturing and tormenting the body. So this seems to be, and then by tormenting the body, and you free the self or the soul from that. That might be part of this kind of, you know, the ox duty ascetic, you know. If I just keep on doing this, I will kind of separate the soul from this evil physical body, and then I will be okay. So there's a number of things here which makes the vows and the virtues work in that way. But yeah, the wonderful thing about Buddhism is that you're allowed to be happy. You know, it's great, isn't it? It's actually okay to be happy. As long as you find the right kind of happiness, you know, you're okay here. Okay, any more last questions before we call it a day? Okay.
If you, John, if you're grieving, if you grieve for a birth, like woman having babies, and next time you will be coming back, same thing as rebirth. I mean, women having babies.
Yeah.
So you reckon they will come back again and again and again, and you won't be out of this santana?
It's a slightly different thing. I mean, just because you have a baby, it doesn't mean that you will be reborn yourself. It's a slightly different thing here.
But still, it's craving.
It's a craving. Probably is a craving, but it's a craving. You know, you want to have something to nurture, and you want to have a child. I mean, I know that's quite common for women. It's probably common for some men as well. And you know, eventually you have to give up that craving as well. But just because you have a child doesn't mean that you're necessarily reborn. Perhaps if you have a child, you think, okay, you know, that was a mistake. You know, maybe that wasn't such a good thing after all. And then once you have realized that, then you practice the path and you make an end of it. You know, that in itself doesn't mean that you will get reborn. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Everybody happy? Yeah. Great. Okay. So let's pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.